Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwain aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 140.
Well, timestamp. Day 25, 21. Morning test of doom.
A stupid thing you could try. It might not work, but it seems like a place to start. Is take the first set of outcomes as your starting guess for the second set of outcomes, and then do the math they learned already to adjust the first set for each additional trial, and then you'd end up with your new estimate. Would that produce the same result if you did it in either direction? It should. So, the difference in estimates from each individual estimate to the combined estimate should be equal if they were tests that ran the same length, which wasn't specified. Is this really better than eternal torture?
Willa's story. Someone reading Willa's thoughts might be surprised to find out that she isn't afraid. She's excited. Willa's good at tests, the tricky 2-4-6 thing from earlier this week notwithstanding. And this one isn't like that. It's pretty well defined. If anything's going to get in her way of being special, it won't be a test like this. She keeps her boosts back for now. She can at least see how to start already. If the first data set has N lefts and M rights, then that would inform a set of relative posteriors, the probability to the power of N times 1 minus the probability to the power of M, for some probability that each ball goes left. Then you would want to normalize those to sum to 1 if possible. You could use the result Keltham already got for that, because it's a pretty hard problem on its own. She looks in her notes and finds that it's the factorial of m times the factorial of n divided by the factorial of m plus n plus 1. So for the first data set, the hypotheses of left probability have their own probabilities. Probability 1 of p equals p to the power of n times 1 minus p to the power of m divided by m factorial times n factorial over factorial of m plus n plus 1. Similarly, if we say the second data set has L lefts and R rights, we can deduce the same probability function there. Probability 2 of P equals P to the power of L times 1 minus P to the power of R divided by R factorial times L factorial over factorial of R plus L plus 1. Willa feels sure somehow that the right solution involves using these two functions together somehow. She could instead just use the first one and then feed the other data into it. But why should one data set be treated differently than the other? The situation is symmetric, so the law should treat them symmetrically. So what's the important thing here? It's tempting to say that the functions want to be the same, but that's wrong. Both functions could have no data at all, and both would be the same flat line, and she'd know nothing at all about if they were the same. To know for sure the probabilities are the same, or different, you would have to know the probability exactly. The function would have to be a lone spike of probability somewhere in each case. Like if probability 1 was a spike at probability equals 0.5, and probability 2 was a spike at probability equals 0.6, then you have a 0% chance they're the same. Similarly, if they're both spikes at probability equals 0.5, there's a 100% chance, as long as the model is right in the first place. But how do you actually process the probability functions to get those 100% or 0% or anything in between chances? Well, what do you always do with probabilities? You multiply them. So then, you'd have to multiply these functions together. With an integral? Will has been feverishly learning calculus since she saw it used to such powerful effect. She thinks you'd integrate the two of them multiplied together, and it would be a definite integral. You'd be integrating over the little probability, the p, so dp. The bounds would have to be from probability equals 0 to probability equals 1, the set of possible outcomes. Would you have to normalize? Scary, she isn't sure. She'll think more about that part later. Integrate p to the power of n times 1 minus p to the power of m divided by m. Factorial times n factorial over factorial of m plus n plus 1 times p to the power of l times 1 minus p to the power of r divided by r factorial times l factorial over factorial of r plus l plus 1 with respect to p from 0 to 1. What a mess. But a lot of this doesn't even have p in it. it can seamlessly escape the integral. Goodbye, denominators. To Abaddon with you. Integrate p to the power of n times 1 minus p to the power of m times p to the power of l times 1 minus p to the power of r. With respect to p, from 0 to 1, divided by m factorial times n factorial times r factorial times l factorial over factorial of m plus n plus 1 times factorial of r plus l plus 1. Rearrange a little bit. Combine like terms. Integrate p to the power of n plus l times 1 minus p to the power of m plus r. With respect to p, from 0 to 1, divided by m factorial times n factorial times r factorial times l factorial over factorial of m plus n plus 1 times factorial of r plus l plus 1. And now it's the same form Keltham had again. She can use exactly what she used to normalize them earlier. She doesn't even have to do any work. She feels like cackling. She doesn't, of course, but she'll remember this later and cackle. Factorial of n plus l times factorial of m plus r, divided by factorial of n plus l plus m plus r plus 1 divided by m, factorial times n factorial times r factorial times l factorial over factorial of m plus n plus 1 times factorial of r plus l plus 1. Clean this up. Factorial of n plus l times factorial of m plus r times factorial of m plus n plus 1 times factorial of r plus l plus 1 divided by factorial of n plus l plus m plus r plus 1 times m factorial times n factorial times r factorial times l factorial. So this could be an answer. But calm down. Don't get overexcited. Okay, that's impossible. But she still had to be a little careful here. First, was she supposed to normalize? She thinks how the flat probability distributions would have looked. Probability of p equals 1 from 0 to 1 would be the flat one. That normalizes properly, she knows. If she integrated that times itself, obviously she'd get 1. Concerning. So she has some normalizing work to do still then. What if it was probability of p equals 2 from 0 to 0.5 for each? Then she'd get 2, from 2 squared equals 4, then 4 times 0.5 equals 2. Makes sense, they're twice as much like each other. So the idea is at least relatively correct. Good. Good. Think of her answer as a rating for now, rather than true probability. Rating equals factorial of n plus l times factorial of m plus r, times factorial of m plus n plus 1, times factorial of r plus l plus 1, divided by factorial of n plus l plus m plus r plus 1 times m, factorial times n, factorial times r, factorial times l, factorial. It occurs to her now that if you assume each true probability can be anything between 0 and 1, the chances they line up exactly should be 0. In a way, it's nonsense to say they can be the same, at least when working in this framework, but they can still be nearer together or farther apart. Maybe what she's looking for is the expected difference in probability, or something like that. The half-full ones were twice as good, and clearly the half-full ones are twice as near together. So distance apart is inversely dependent on rating. Almost surely. What's the average distance apart for rating one, then? That's the key to all this. She can work from that to get everything. But there's something tricky here. She feels a tinge of suspicion. Owl's wisdom. And she realizes she's at least a little wrong. The 0.5 and 0.6 spikes she thought about before would have rating 0, and they're very definitely 0.1 apart. Darn. Is this the end of the road for the two-function method? But this sort of thing would have to happen no matter how she does it, wouldn't it? If she's working from an initial prior that the true probability 1 can be anything between 0 and 1, and the true probability 2 can be as well, then the odds of them ever being the same must always be 0. She's so tempted to ask Keltham what the heck this problem is even supposed to be then, but she forces herself not to. This must be part of the test. So let's think about this a little more, in a new and strange direction. Imagine she had a prior not about probability 1 or probability 2 individually, but about them being the same. If her prior was 1/2, that's sort of like saying probability 1 or probability 2 can each be one of two values, with equal chance, and they might line up or might not, and one-third chance of being the same would be three different values, and so on. So maybe the chance P1 equals P2 is something you have to get both from the prior probability Q that P1 equals P2 and from the data itself. Maybe her rating is useful after all. Let's think of some cases. 0.5 spike and 0.6 spike, rating 0. Chance they're the same, always 0. Full flat and full flat, rating 1. Chance they're the same? Well, the full flats are like having no data at all, which means the chance must remain Q, the prior you started with. Half flat and half flat, rating 2. Well, you definitely don't multiply, since Q might be more than 0.5, and 2 times Q would then be more than 1. Bad. But the chance is definitely more than Q. 0.5 spike and 0.5 spike. Rating infinity. Has to be. Infinitely squished together. So infinitely big. Rating. Probability has to be 1. So what sort of function looks like that? Multiplying is dumb. What about an exponent? But Q is less than 1 and big rating is good. So maybe updated probability of same equals Q raised to the power of 1 divided by rating? It's a wild guess. But it gets points for being a simple guess, at least. So this would mean half flats with rating 2 would give you square root of Q. 0.5 upgrading to 0.707. It seems plausible? It's at least something to use as a backup plan. It's not a terrible try. Can she work it out from first principles now that she has a better idea what she's doing? Or maybe find that it's wrong and see something better? Owl's wisdom runs out, and she decides to cool off for a little. Do some sanity checks on her rating to make sure it even makes sense. It gets better and better as both cluster to the same side, and worse as they cluster to opposite sides. Okay, good. She's pretty sure now that the problem needs a Q. The way it's framed doesn't make any sense without it. If there were buckets, you could make guesses about bucket priors, and it might be doable without a Q. But there are no buckets, and buckets are mean and nasty anyway. They went over that. And if you take a totally random 0 to 1 as the prior for both, then the answer to the question is just 0, and it's boring. You need a Q. But how do you go from Q to anything useful? As necessary as it is, it's kind of an obnoxious object. She thinks about it hard, doesn't get anywhere, and then decides it's time for Fox's cunning. Let's go back to those half-flat functions. 2 from P equals 0 to P equals 0.5, 0 elsewhere. Imagine I'm given Q equals 0.5, and that function for each data set. What do I conclude? It's difficult because the probability weight of the functions together is sort of fundamentally a line-shaped thing, and the functions apart is an area-shaped thing. But she knows it isn't an infinite update in favor of them being not the same. That'd be silly. The two full flats make for no update at all. Maybe she can use that? With the full flats, the rating is 1. And Q isn't updated at all. That means same and not same had the same likelihood there. For the half flats, the rating is 2. So in a sense, the likelihood of same has doubled. The likelihood of not same, maybe that can't really change. The total probability area can't really be affected by the little probability line. So imagine a rating of 2 is a 2-to-1 update. That feels right in a comforting way. Her ratings are just likelihoods, basically. So, updated probability equals 0.5 times 2, divided by 0.5 times 2 plus 0.5 equals 2/3. Great, that makes sense. Or generally, updated probability of same equals Q times rating divided by Q times rating plus 1 minus Q. Yes. She's going to register a second instance of cackling to be saved for later now. So in summary, prior probability of same equals Q. Set 1, L lefts, R rights. Set 2, n lefts, m rights, factorial of n plus l times factorial of m plus r times factorial of m plus n plus 1 times factorial of r plus l plus 1. Rating equals the above product divided by factorial of n plus l plus m plus r plus 1 times factorial of m times factorial of n times factorial of r times factorial of l equals likelihood ratio of same versus not same. Updated probability of same equals Q times rating divided by Q times rating plus 1 minus Q. In civilization, they wouldn't even give a prior cue as a guess in most cases, just the rating, aka the likelihood ratio. But she figures it's good to be very clear about how one should handle their cue, if they had one and wanted to do something with it. Do her old sanity checks still work? Rating of 0 gives update to 0. Rating of infinity gives update to 1. Rating of 1 still gives update to Q. And this is more like the real language of probability than her first guess. It's actually justified, at least sort of. She thinks that for now, this is as good as she can get with the main part of the problem. But this is so, so, so important. She gets her second Fox's Cunning from staff, and then spends the first minute of it looking over everything she's done again, just in case. Nothing else catches her eye, so she starts thinking about the rest in truth now. So she starts writing paragraphs after all the equations interspersed with notes. Now imagine that the P you're looking for really is the same, and you have some mediocre prior Q of that to start with. Let's say P equals 0.5, but one experiment is leaning right a little, and one left a little, so their true probabilities are P1 equals 0.45 and P2 equals 0.55. With small amounts of data in both experiments, the probability functions won't be very sharp. They'll just be soft hills, taller in the middle, and the rating you get by combining them will still be higher than 1, and update Q in the correct direction, towards same. But as you took more and more data, the functions get sharper and sharper, like her imaginary spikes. Eventually, you'll have spike-like functions at 0.45 and 0.55, and they'll barely even intersect. The rating would be terrible, much less than 1, and update Q in the wrong direction, towards not same. So at first, if the experiments just had a little data, comparing them would suggest the right result. But as they got more and more, the problem would get magnified, and it would eventually start suggesting the wrong result instead. It almost seems like a paradox. More data should be making things better, but it's making things worse. It's because even if the data is real data, the probability functions from it are sort of lies, if you think they're referencing the true behavior and not just the data from the experiment. P1 and P2 aren't really quite the same thing. They're both just nearby shadows of the same P. So really, the law isn't lying to you. It's saying P1 and P2 are probably different, and they are. But that's just about the experiments, not about P itself. So when you look at an experiment, you should maybe limit how spiky you let your probability function get for the true P. You need to force it to be at least as wide as the inherent errors in the experiment are big. Exactly how wide you force it to be, and how to do that with law instead of with hand-waving, is probably the subject of another problem. It seems like a big, difficult problem, and she's fresh out of Foxes and Owls. So that's that with that for now. But as lunch approaches and she looks her paper over, she feels confident. Maybe some of this is wrong, it's possible, but she doesn't think it could be wrong enough to sink her.
Korva's story. Korva misbudgeted her time last night. Her requested books about the history of wizard education had come through, and she, idiot that she is, had spent time reading them, hoping that she could make up the 5 hours it would probably take her to fully understand the rule of succession early tomorrow. If not for the instruction to prep specific spells, she might have tried to pull an all-nighter understanding the math, which she did do earlier this week, before their ostensible day off. But even though she can't actually prep Fox's Cunning or Owl's Wisdom, she didn't want to be the only person who couldn't prep anything, couldn't even prestidigitate her name tag. She managed to cram a little work in during breakfast after spending more effort than usual prepping her spells, but if anything, it made her feel more confused. She should have realized that this was going to be a test day. Stupid. She has her notes, but there's no time to do the necessary work to fully understand them. She could try copying the exact math that Pilar and Asmodia did, without understanding which parts are different in this problem. But Keltham will see through that immediately, and honestly, she's not sure she can do the math, actually. She looks at it and tries to read the problem, and there's just nothing, no understanding left in her brain. She tries copying the literal symbols that she wrote down in her notes in case that jogs something loose, but it doesn't seem to. She keeps staring at it without comprehending. She's gonna die. No, worse than die. She's going to be rendered completely useless for the entirety of her existence. Maybe she should take some comfort in the fact that this cruelty to her must be making Keltham more evil than he already is. But she doesn't think that's the sort of contribution to evil that gets you a duchy, or a spot in the Library of Oaths, or a few more years of mortal existence. She hates Keltham, violently and passionately, for stealing her perfectly good life from her and buying her like a slave, without so much as checking beforehand whether he would want to use her or cast her aside like so much refuse. He is able to do so, and so he did, and it doesn't really make any sense to be angry about people using the power they have to hurt you however they want, but she hates him for it anyway. She wants to punch him, or maybe cut his head off, or maybe rip his eyes out, or maybe just scream at all of the gods who are so obsessed with him that he's a self-important teenage idiot, that he's nothing special among his people and only very coincidentally of any interest to theirs, that he's a cleric, a fourth circle cleric, of Abadar, who is nonetheless too careless to realize that he owns his trading partners like chattel and that any talk of paying them is farcical and that in general he deserves to be in the same stupid, awful position as the rest of them and not only doesn't have the basic residual humanity to feel embarrassed about his wholly undeserved position, he doesn't even notice that it's undeserved. Hasn't even noticed that he's an incredibly shitty teacher, even though he's been trying to cram months of lessons into them in a matter of weeks because he assumes that adults can learn things that much faster than children, even though they can't. There's no reason to think they could. They can't do it with languages, and they probably can't do it with math either unless they are geniuses who are doing way more work than they should have to do to make up for his shitty-ass technique. Except that some people can. The other people in this class can. The only person she hates more than Keltham is herself. Her hatred for herself is blinding, searing, like being shot through with a piece of the sun. She thinks that she might feel a small piece of what Asmodeus feels about her, some tiny percentage of the full weight of the agony of being human and a not even very impressive human at that. The only thing she can think to do at all is to write something. Not math. She doesn't have any math in her. She has words, ugly and shifting and imprecise and disgusting and human, but Keltham prefers wrong answers to no answers, so she will at least try to give him the stunningly wrong answer that she has. There are two tables, each of which produces sets of right and left. She wants to know whether they output the same or different frequencies of lefts and rights. The first thing to note is that, per previous lessons, you can't know. A civilization experimentalist would, what? They would have multiple possible specific underlying frequencies of left and right for each source to be hypotheses, and then calculate the likelihood of getting each specific data set in each of the worlds where a given possible frequency was the true frequency. And then they would, what, you need to compare them. But you're not supposed to use hypotheses that rely on comparisons between multiple data sets. That also doesn't use the rule of succession, obviously, because she's only dimly aware of what the rule of succession even is. It's something to do with breaking the space of possibilities into infinite pieces, which you'd think would allow you to identify the specific hypothesis that is most likely, maybe, for each of the data sets. And then, how would you present it? The most likely frequency, plus how likely this data set is if you have the true frequency. Maybe. Although that has as much to do with the size of the data set as with whether you're right. And then given that information, you can at least say how likely it is that the data sets have the same frequency, and then you'd have to calculate it somehow. Her paper is wet. She looks at the calculations in her notes one last time, and her brain just slides off of them. Might as well be written in Celestial or Ancient Aslanti. She writes her stupid, probably incoherent verbal description of how a civilization experimentalist might structure their analysis, doesn't do any actual calculations, buries her head in her arms on her desk and waits for someone who thinks that the garbage never cries in Tal'Dor to kill her and replace her with someone less distraught. One of the other students will target her later anyway, even if security doesn't.
Alexandra Esquera, Hate and Fear, Avelmar, Alexandra's story. So the simple solution is that he lists a set of possible starting theories, doing his limited best to carve up all available regions of idea space visible to him, then describes which sequences he would consider evidence for each theory, then describe how to compare the relative ratios. Again, this is all simple things Keltham taught them. He'll also want to come up with a way to mathematically describe. All theories have unexpectedly low predictive power. That ought to be very simple given that Keltham already told them what it looks like. The obvious way to note an error is just them getting very different results. In particular, getting results that form very different curves. If it looks like slightly different concentrations along a curve when you combine them, or one of them being thrown by one odd result, those are checkable things, but if, in general, it looks like the thing they are measuring has a different shape, probably the thing they are measuring has a very different shape. If they can't predict each other, a very plausible outcome is that they aren't the each other they're trying to predict. He can put that into math. And Alexandra will quietly enjoy himself, producing not really a general solution for the problem, because given that individual people will start with their own individual beliefs, many of which they are not explicitly writing down anywhere, he does not think he can do that, but something that, given a little work to turn his neat little descriptions into pseudocode, would work quite well as a computer program for interpreting results and adjusting your priors into posteriors based on them. If any computers happen to exist in Golarion that could run it.
Dathilan commentary. Alexandra's methodology would work great if Golarion had a hypercomputer that could check an infinite variety of infinitary metahypotheses. Yes. It's getting anything done with a finite amount of computation that makes science analysis be non-trivial. But it sure beats not even knowing how to solve the problem using a hypercomputer. And frankly, not all of the researcher candidates are getting anywhere near that far.
Carissa's story. Carissa should have put these students through more stressful things so they wouldn't be so stressed out by tests. That's a failure of Chelish education, having failed to give students something to be more scared of than math. Unless the problem is that the students are scared of hell and therefore not solvable that way. But they're not even sending the rejects to hell. She entertains the temptation to order everyone to believe that they're not going to be executed for math inadequacy, just so that when this situation inevitably happens anyway, they'll know it's their own fault for disobeying orders. Somehow, though, it doesn't seem like that would actually fix the problem. Carissa has a headband that amounts to fox's cunning all the time, and has taken to preparing 3 or 4 owls' wisdoms a day. It's an unfair advantage, but life and death and everything else are unfair. Keltham wants a rule for calculating a likelihood ratio between the same theory and the not same theory. If they're in fact the same, then she can add up the lefts from both experiments and the rights from both experiments and get odds of left, right of N1 plus N2 plus 1, M1 plus M2 plus 1. If they're different, then the odds for the first experiment are N1 plus 1, M1 plus 1, and the odds for the second experiment are N2 plus 1, M2 plus 1. Then to get the propensity PE from the left. Right ratio, you have to do that deeply unpleasant thing with the factorials, which is going to make everything else messy. She digs it out of her notes. P, M, N, M plus N plus 1, P1, M1, N1, M1 plus N1 plus 1, P2, M2, N2, M2 plus N2 plus 1. P combo, M1 plus M2, N1 plus N2, M1 plus M2 plus N1 plus N1 plus 1. Right, okay, so the odds ratio between the same and not same theories is just P combo slash P1P2, which looks hideous. N1 plus N2, M1 plus M2, M1 plus N1 plus 1, M2 plus N2 plus 1, N1 plus N2 plus M1 plus M2 plus 1, M1. N1, M2, N2. But conceptually, it's not all that hideous. Presumably, if you'd done this experiment, you'd want to report the actual data and the counts of left and right, and also your likelihood functions on the actual propensities, and then your likelihood function on same. Different. She feels like the third question is getting at something particular. Not just as the general principle that if your two data sources are different, then you wouldn't want to combine them and treat them as more observations from the same process. But she's not actually sure what in particular. Presumably, you could just notice that the dense bits of your likelihood function for each look very different from the dense bits of your likelihood function for the combination, and that if you ever notice that it's a bad sign. Are they supposed to formalize that? It seems surprisingly hard to formalize, but she does have almost 2 hours to go. Some of the new students look miserable. To be fair, she's not at all sure that without a headband, she wouldn't be just as miserable. She's going to not try to formalize that, she thinks, and instead fold up her notes and hand them in to Keltham and then tilt her head at him invitingly and head to the library.
A Median Dathilani story. The Median Dathilani has, by Galarian standards, some power that Galarian knows not, or aptitude that it knows very little. It isn't easily captured by the anti-score that is measured by detect thoughts. Even if you add in whatever wisdom is measured by detect anxieties, there's some residual that isn't measured still. It's not just about the training the Dathilani undergo in childhood. No, really, it's not. They have been doing a lot of mate selection, and not just since there have been prediction markets about what kind of children would result. If somehow you took the Median Dathilani and exposed them to only a few fragments of lore such as Keltham has already taught, a few stories about cognitive science such as Keltham has already told, if they'd had only that little true education by the time they'd reached adulthood, the Median Dathilani would still be told of the law of succession and think spontaneously, without any outside prompting, of how you could use that to guess whether two sources were the same or different. Just look at the scores if you use the law of succession twice, separately, versus using the law of succession on both of them together. The difference between those scores is the likelihood ratio for different versus same. If you get 4 left and 1 right off one source, and 4 right and 1 left off another source, then analysing them separately gives you scores for each of 4 factorial times. 1 factorial divided by 6 factorial equals 1 factorial times 4. Factorial divided by 6. Factorial equals 24 divided by 720 equals obviously 1 divided by 30. Just look at the factorials. Analyzing both datasets together gives you 5 factorial times 5 factorial divided by 11 factorial, which you can see intuitively is going to end up around 1 divided by 1024, minus over a bit for the product being 1 divided by 2, times 1 divided by 3 times 2 divided by 4 times 2, divided by 5 times 3 divided by 6 times 3 divided by 7, instead of just 1, divided by 2, raised to the power of 10. It's actually 1 divided by 2772 if you bother to calculate. Not as nightmarish as it looks, you can cancel a lot of factors. Point is, you've got a set of 2 likelihood functions for 2 separate datasets versus 1 likelihood function on the combined dataset, where, if you started with a uniform prior on 3 propensity spaces and multiplied by all those likelihood functions, the 2 separate functions would destroy all but 1 divided by 30 of the probability on each of the 2 separate spaces, and the combined likelihood function would destroy all but 1 divided by 2772 of the uniform probability on its own parameter space. It's not to the point where if you literally pulled a coin and flipped it 5 times twice, you'd conclude shenanigans from seeing 4 left and 1 right the first time, versus 1 right and 4 left the second time. That's just a likelihood ratio of 1 divided by 900 versus 1 divided by 1024. But if the problem is more mysterious than that, if you are less certain at the start that your data is coming from a single source across both cases, then you'd be looking at an update of more like 2,772 to 900, approximately 3-to-1 that they were 2 separate sources. After that, if it wasn't pretty plausible to start, it's not plausible yet now, after so little data. If you were already pretty suspicious, you're now quite noticeably more suspicious, though. The Median Dathilani, even given only such education as Keltham has already provided, fewer hints than that, even, would spontaneously generalise the principle of taking alarm if 2 experiments seem to have non-overlapping likelihood functions. Suppose the likelihood functions are over a simple hypothesis space, such that likelihood functions form clouds naturally visible in that space, such that there is a natural way to informally see boundaries around narrow subvolumes of the clouds. You can't say it in an absolute way, apart from some prior and arbitrary concept of how to draw boundaries like that and divide up the space. You could always throw some random points into an otherwise compact cloud and say that you thought they should be in there. But informally, it's natural enough to see 376 lefts and 624 rights. Look at the likelihood function, passion data, / propensity p, equals p raised to the power of 376 times 1 minus p, raised to the power of 624, and say, that cloud has 90% of its density between p equals 35% and p equals 40%. If you widen to the amount between p equals 30% and p equals 45%, that's 99.9999% of the likelihood density. And then let's say that you run a different experiment, and it turns up 602 lefts and 398 rights. Informally, for there is no way to say it formally without introducing an arbitrary note of subjectivity. We are looking to cues that the data gives us to look outside our hypothesis space, and there is a limit to how much you can ever formalize that, without invoking enough lore to create a mortal from scratch. Informally, you look at that and say no way in superheated toilet paper are those the same two data sources. The overlap of the two clouds in likelihood space is virtually zero. They have each eliminated practically all of the probability from any hypothesis that could non-stupidly account for the other, and those two different stories cannot exist in the same world. You do not combine the data from the two experiments to estimate the parameter. No, not even in sane worlds where all you do to combine the analyses from two experiments is just multiply their two likelihood functions together. Sure, you can multiply phi raised to the power of 376 times 1 minus p raised to the power of 624 by p raised to the power of 602 times 1 minus p raised to the power of 398 and get a p raised to the power of 978 times 1 minus p raised to the power of 1022, but you obviously shouldn't do that. The first trial concentrates 99.9999% of its survivability between propensities of 0.30 and 0.45, and the second concentrates 99.9995% of its survivability between 0.53 and 0.67. There's no overlap between what the two datasets say are the livable regions of the parameter space. These two experiments were not conducted with the same world feeding them their answers, though ultimately they were conducted inside the same greater reality. Something is wrong in one place or both. It's just one of those things that, like, is incredibly important to doing real science and jumps directly out at you once you start thinking about experimental reports in terms of likelihoods, which, in fact, the median Dathilani will do even if nobody explicitly tells them so, and even if their entire world tries to tell them otherwise.
Asmodia's story. Did Asmodia always have that strange thing in her that the median Dathilani possesses? Did she have it before Atolmans touched her? Did she have it before her hour-long epiphany wearing an artifact headband? Whatever that strange quality is, Asmodia has it now, somehow, outside of Dathilan. And if she is not a Dathilani yet, not any kind of Ilani, for being so untrained, she is now recognizably an untrained Ilani. Point being, Asmodia already thought through all of Keltham's questions earlier, during the Law of Succession lecture. He'd certainly hinted heavily enough that he was going to ask questions in those directions, practically spelled it out even. Asmodia writes down all the obvious stuff, thinks a bit more, writes down some speculations about, well, maybe you could also update the rule of succession on the first data bunch, ask how well it expected to score, and then further update the rule on the second data bunch to see if it scored around that well. And also do the reverse, and if in either case the further updated rule scored much more poorly than it expected to score after the first update, that might indicate a problem. But it's not really a 3-hour question. Is she missing something? If she's not missing something, Asmodia is sort of worried about how much Keltham is softballing the new researchers here. This seems like really basic and obvious law of probability. What's the catch? She spends a while staring at her paper, but when Carissa Sevar hands in her own version, Asmodia sort of quietly sighs to herself and hands in her own as Keltham walks out with Sevar.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to Executive Producer John Doe 7776059.